listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. And this is your true community radio station here in Florida. And this is your news and public affairs show, The Surreal News, which is coming right up. Don't touch that dial. Well, we're going to bring that music down. I'm Steve Norris. My co-host is Lou Larini. And you're listening to our public news and public affairs show, The Surreal News. And we want to remind everybody that we have our fund drive coming up next week. So next week, you're going to be listening to us during our fund drive. We have Christine Jennings, the new head of the Sarasota Democratic Party, coming on next week as well. That should be interesting. All right, Lou, who's on this week, though?
Well, this week we're going to have Shelley Freeland Eddy. She is a Sarasota attorney who is running for District 3 of the Sarasota City Council. She's going to be on, and she's going to be telling us a little bit about herself and what she thinks is, important for, voters and residents of Sarasota City. But then later on in the show, we're going to have author Henry Vincent, who wrote a book called Confessions of a D.C. Madam, describing his experiences running a gay escort service in Washington, D.C. in the 80s. It is going to be what it sounds like.
the inside power struggle among escort services, gay escort services.
Well, in D.C. and blackmail and,
there's jail time involved and power struggles.
Famous people.
Sex and...
Just...
Remember that guy Craig
We will keep it PG-rated. We are a family show.
It's going to be very surreal. All right. Well, speaking of gays, sort of there's some gay news in the news as well. So tell us about some things we need to know about there.
Well, President Barack Obama has called for an end to conversion therapies for LGBT youth. The president urged an end to the psychiatric therapies that seek to change the sexual orientation of gay, lesbian, and transgender people. That was what in the White House statement written by senior advisor Valerie Jarrett came out Wednesday in response to a petition calling for Obama to back a law to ban conversion therapy, which is supported by some socially conservative organizations and religious doctors. The petition was started following the suicide in December of 17-year-old transgender youth Leela Alcorn, who said she was forced to attend conversion therapy, pulled out of school, and isolated. Quote, the overwhelming scientific evidence demonstrates that conversion therapy, especially when it's practiced on young people, is neither medically nor ethically appropriate and can cause substantial harm, Jarrett said.
Ouch.
But what's going on here in Florida, though?
All right, so in Florida, yesterday, our house... The Florida House approved a bill to let adoption agencies refuse gay parents. This has come about before, sort of ruled unconstitutional. This is sort of another stab at this. So yesterday, Florida lawmakers approved a measure that would allow private adoption agencies to refuse to let gay couples adopt children. So the House passed it 75-38. And what it does is it prevents the state from revoking the license or refusing funding to adoption agencies that refuse to let a gay couple adopt a child for religious or moral grounds. In other words, if you're a private adoption agency and you refuse to let a gay couple adopt, you can no longer be penalized for that if this bill goes through. All right, I know it's sort of a double negative, but that's the way it works. So the supporters say they needed the bill to keep faith-based adoption agencies open. That's what they said. In the past, there was actually earlier in the week, the Senate passed a different bill eliminating a ban on gay adoption from state law. And that was a sort of a symbolic bill because of the Third District Court of Appeals ruled that Florida's ban on gay adoption was unconstitutional in 2010. There's a lot of sort of unnecessary stuff going on here because this was unconstitutional anyway. There are other states where agencies are being shut down and they didn't believe that they should discriminate against them, etc. That was sort of the thought behind this. Any comments about that?
Well, you know, it just seems to be, I mean, broadly, Steve, you know, it's another case of, you know, politicians, you know, trying to establish their conservative bona fides. And it seems like whenever they try to do that, there's some serious contradiction, a lot of waste of time, and, you know, trying to, you know, abolish or get rid of things like, for instance, you know, trying to repeal Obamacare. What is it? It's in the 40s, you know, for the House. And that's what that's all about. And I think these, even after courts rule that it's unconstitutional to prevent gay couples from adopting children, these guys are still trying to say that we can pass a law that says that gay couples, or make it harder for gay couples to adopt children.
And what's interesting, in some of the court cases where they determined that it was unconstitutional, when they asked for evidence, for example, that gay couples then would have a negative impact on the children that they raise, there was no evidence at all. And the judge, if you remember, we reported some of this back then, said that there's no evidence to say that there's any problems here. So we need to. So this is unconstitutional.
Yeah, loving and supporting supportive parents, regardless of gender, you know, have good outcomes raising children. And as anybody who's ever had a child knows, you know, it really does take two. I have the greatest sympathy for, you know, single parents, both, you know, male and female, having raised a child. One child myself with my wife and I, and it was a handful, you know, and people that have more than one, you know, for the two of us, we've often talked about that and said, man, you know, even with like one child, I don't know how I could have done all this by myself without your help.
Yeah, so what we have here is we have absolutely no evidence of gay couples hurting children that they raise.
Right.
However, that topic is extremely popular for raising money. So what we have is some politicians who completely ignore any reality and use that same lie for fundraising.
As
and
I said,
it works great.
Well, yeah, like
it's
I said.
Fabulous.
Like
for
I
example,
said.
You had that couple in Indiana, or the company in Indiana that refused to give pizza to the gay.
Right.
They made a fortune.
Well, over $800,000 and $842,000 in donations. And they just came on the news and said, you know, because of religious beliefs, if a gay couple came in here and wanted us to cater their wedding, we would refuse, you know, which also is like a real stretch because
not on religious rights, on financial rights.
Yeah, right.
So here's
yeah,
a new opportunity for everybody here. Myself, we can all move to Indiana, open up a pizza parlor and refuse to serve gays, you'll make a fortune.
Well, just get on the news and say you will.
Yeah, get on the news. So let's all move to Indiana, refuse to serve gays, and you can make a fortune by all the, well, ignorant people out there that are willing to ignore reality.
Sure.
And just spend money. If you're willing to ignore reality and discriminate, you can make a fortune that way. It's great business.
Right. It is. It is.
It's great business. All right, let's... Where do you want to go from here?
Well, you know, I want to talk about Maya Angelou because I know this is probably
a little surreal twist.
I know it's been reported everywhere, but like Maya Angelou, she is one of my favorite writers, and she has said many, many quotable things.
Yes, and this is our stamp segue here.
Yeah,
so you're going to do a stamp story, then
right.
I'm going to do a stamp story.
Okay,
just
well,
like we both did a gay story. Now we'll do some stamp stories here.
You know, and never apologize, never explain. That more or less sums up the U.S. Postal Service's attitude this week on Tuesday when it issued a stamp in honor of the American author Maya Angelou, who died last year. Next to a photograph of Angelou is a famous quote from her. Quote, "A bird doesn't sing because it has an answer. It sings because it has
a song.
How sweet. There is just one problem. She never said it."
That wasn't her quote.
The quote actually comes from a poem published in 1967 by children's writer Joan Walsh Englund. And basically, the fault may lie with President Obama, who attributed the line to Angelou in an address last year. The U.S. Postal Service initially defended using the quote, arguing that it was associated with Angelou. Now it is reluctantly backtracking, but there is no suggestion that the stamp will be withdrawn, possibly because it is part of the series called Forever, Memorializing Great People and events.
And also the author of the original author of the quote.
Right. Yeah, there you go.
Said,
that's right.
Said
yeah.
She didn't mind. She said it's fine. she loved being associated with Maya Angelou anyway.
Absolutely. But I mean, apparently it is, according to the story, and I won't go through them, you know, like a long list of lines attributed to people, you know,
right.
that weren't really, they never really said it. Just somehow, you know, it's one of those things where you get in a room and you whisper something in somebody's ear, and then they whisper it in somebody else's ear, and that line, by the time you get through like 10 people, completely changes. Well, I guess that's true in real life, too.
Isn't that called like, was there telephone or... There's a name for that.
Yeah, there
anyway.
Is, yeah, there is.
Okay,
yeah.
More stamps. Food stamps this time. The new GOP lie is that food stamps can be used for cruise ships. So if you're Governor Brownback, you're going to sign a bill in Kansas that says that you can't use food stamps for cruise ships. Even though it's a fake problem, here we have another.
Yeah.
Let's spend all our time and energy and legislation on another fake problem here, like
save up 10 years worth of food stamps,
okay?
So you can buy a ticket on a cruise ship.
So you can't use food stamps on cruise ships.
Preposterous.
So anyway, so the new law also bans things like shopping at jewelry stores and lingerie shops, video arcades, theme parks, and swimming pools. What's interesting, I think it was on The Daily Show, they were talking about lingerie shops, that why are we so concerned about the type of underwear? If you buy underwear in an underwear store, it's fine, but if you buy the same underwear in a lingerie shop using your food stamps, you can't. Why are we so interested in the underwear that people on welfare have? I don't know, but that's how Kansas is spending their time in their legislature.
Can't have luxury, fabrics next to your body.
There you go.
Taxpayer
TANF funds, temporary assistance for needier families, and their EBT cards, electronic benefits transaction cards, are what we're talking about here. Now the legislature has put some restrictions on that. What's interesting in that bill there is also a limitation that you can't draw more than $25 a day from an ATM machine. Sounds reasonable.
Sure.
The problem is most ATM machines don't deal in $5 increments. They only got tens. So that when you say you can't get more than 25, well, if there's no fives, that means you can only get 20. Plus, there's an 85 cent fee that they attach to those. So that means that, and then there's another couple of dollars for the ATM fee sometimes. So they just made it much harder for the poor to get money, and they're giving much more money by percentage to the banks.
Because that's true. I mean, that makes sense. There would be a pile of fees because, you know, I mean, it seems logical that a person who's on food stamps probably doesn't have a bank account somewhere.
Right.
I mean, those of us that have bank accounts.
So here they limited falsely the amount of money that they could get and increased relatively the amount of fees, all over a lie here about food stamps on cruise ships that don't exist. All right. More.
But just one
falsities
more
falsities in the news here. You know, that's what we love to report here.
You know, but I mean, one more thing that I want to add and remind everybody. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me right now, but the food stamp program is like just a fraction of a point of the U.S. budget, and we spend like lots more money. I mean, there's all. I'll tell you, just.
All right, I have a great story
whatever.
I want to get to.
Yes, go.
You want to do your quick one, and then I'll go there, but keep it quick. Your China.
China's trying to avoid the problem Americans had being called the ugly American when they traveled overseas. You know, China will now keep records of uncivilized behavior by tourists for up to 2 years. The country's tourism agency said to combat the spate of incidences abroad in recent years, which reflected badly on their.
Yeah, China's tracking tourists there. Right?
You know, essentially, you know, I just have to say one. I mean, a Chinese student sparked outcry in Egypt after scratching his name in the wall of the ancient temple in Luxor. And a mainland couple drew ire in Hong Kong for allowing their 2-year-old child to defecate on the sidewalk. These are some things that need to be stopped, I guess.
All right. Let me just quickly get to one quick story here because I think it's very interesting, and that's the DEA. That's the National
Drug Enforcement Agency
for the government. Wants to triple the production of government marijuana for research. The details here are kind of interesting, actually. So the government, the DA said that the federal government should produce almost 900 pounds of marijuana for research for this year. It projected it increased its projection from 125 kilograms, which is about 276 pounds, to 400 kilograms, about 900 pounds, because of an unanticipated medical, scientific, research, and industrial needs in the United States. What's interesting here is that there's a last year, the government approved production of 650 kilograms. That's about almost 1,500 pounds of marijuana. They have research involving cannabidinol, the compound in marijuana, that CBD stuff, which is promising for medical research, and that there's high demand for this, increasing beyond what was previously anticipated for ongoing research. There are over 100 cannabinoid compounds for scientists available, research grade, by the government. I don't know if you know that. And they're using it for research for aggressive cancer. Yep. Slowing the spread of HIV. The progression of Alzheimer's disease, this is research going on. And the government also awarded as much as $70 million over the next 5 years to the University of Mississippi for marijuana research. 23 states have legalized marijuana for medical purposes and 12 limited cannabinoid use for medical marijuana, the CBD-rich strains of medical marijuana. Four states, along with D.C., have legalized recreational marijuana. 19 states have decriminalized the possession. All right, that's interesting. That's it for our news. Let's go to a quick Media Matters Minute, and then we have our guests coming up. 1 second here, and we'll get that going. Don't touch that dial.
I'm John Whitehouse. On Fox News Sunday, Fox News contributor George Will slammed the March jobs report and revived a debunked myth about President Reagan's job creation numbers.
Let your mind go back to November last year. There was job creation of 321,000 jobs, and the administration said this is a miraculous achievement and a harbinger of things to come. It wasn't a harbinger, and it wasn't miraculous. During the Reagan recovery, there were 23 months of job creation over 300,000. Reagan had a month of job creation of 1 million, and this was at a time when there were 75 million fewer Americans.
But Will overstates the facts. Reagan's million job month in September 1983 was due to nearly 675,000 striking communication workers returning to work. In fact, the average monthly job growth during the Reagan administration was 168,000. The March jobs report marked the first time in a year there haven't been at least 200,000 new jobs created during a one-month period.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
And we'd like to thank Media Matters. They're a nonprofit out of Washington, D.C. that listens to all that misinformation and reports it on the news. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. Your true community radio station right here in Sarasota. And this is your news and public affairs show, The Surreal News. I'm Steve Norris. My co-host is Lou Larini, and he's going to introduce our guest.
Yeah. Joining us today is Shelley Friedland Eddy. She is a Sarasota attorney who's running for the District 3 seat on Sarasota City Commission against the incumbent Stan Zimmerman. Welcome, Shelley. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning. I'm great. How are you?
Great, great. First off, Shelley, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, leading into what inspired you to want to be on the Sarasota City Commission.
Well, you know, I've been a person that's always been involved in service and, you know, from childhood in terms of being involved with, you know, Girl Scouts and 4-H and Future Business Leaders of America, there were always opportunities to learn and grow even in high school and college. And coming up through college, working in student government and then moving on to begin the practice of law, there were always opportunities to serve. And I've always been a person that's been a problem solver. I've worked with individuals and been mentored in my past as a student and as an adult, and have carried that on into my public service life. And so moving here, you know, into our community over 12 years ago and working with different communities and committees, I've had an opportunity to kind of be able to support what's going on in our beautiful city. We have a wonderful city. There are so many opportunities for growth, and I've been able to serve and volunteer and been able to come to a place where I could provide some leadership and some fresh ideas that would move our city forward. I've served in different capacities in the community with the Human Relations Board and the Community Redevelopment Advisory Act Board, and some of those things have led to opportunities to be able to serve our city on a broader scale. So I'm just happy to have an opportunity to bring my skills and training to the City Commission and look forward to implementing some fresh ideas that will move our city forward.
You know, that is quite true about your involvement. I mean, it's way too copious to list now, but, you know, there is basically sort of a page of things that, you know, you've been doing in the 12 years that you've been in this area. Let's get down to business, though. What do you see basically as the most important and or difficult issues facing the city of Sarasota that the county, that the city commission, you know, needs to deal with?
Well, I think that there are two. One is managing our budget. You know, we've got to be able to have a fiscally responsible city commission that is a guard of our taxpayer dollars. And that leads into the ability to solve some of our pressing issues, which includes our homeless crisis, which includes transportation issues, which includes the expansion of the North Trail in terms of development, which includes protecting and preserving our neighborhoods and our green spaces. We've got to have funds to be able to do that, and we've got to be able to do that in a fiscally responsible way. So I think the first part of the equation or the puzzle, so to speak, is solving that issue of fiscal responsibility and good management of our taxpayer dollars. I think the other side of that is improving our relationship with the county commission so that we can work on some joint issues and tackle those things together. So I think the management piece and then the corporation piece of working with the county go hand in hand.
You know, now you talk about managing the budget. I mean, have there been, are there like shortcomings now? I mean, managing the budget?
There are shortcomings. If we look at some of the major projects that have happened within the city of Sarasota recently, you know, with as it relates to the Lift Station 87, it's over budget by about $18 million. The State Street Garage is over budget by about $4 million. There are deficits in the pensions plans for our retired first responders and firefighters, over $3 million. And then, of course, we have the payment of legal fees that has exceeded over $100,000. And to me, that's just a symptom of the lack of management and oversight that's occurring at the City Commission at this time. We've got to be able to bring some incentives and ideas to be smart in the way we spend our money, to not spend more than we have, and to also develop some public and private partnerships that will give us ways to bring down that deficit where we can, and we just have to do better in terms of spending.
Okay, and you know, and I guess to do better in terms of spending, I mean, we're always talking about more oversight, correct? I mean, people need to be paying attention to the numbers, and that's how things go over budget. I mean, they present a plan and then don't follow through with it, right? I mean, is that part of what the problem is?
I think part of it is not following through, and I think part of it is just being a good manager of what we can do at the right time. We can't do everything all at once. We've got to be smart and prioritize. We've got to sit down and figure out what we can afford, and then we've got to be able to hold people to their word in terms of how much things cost. I think there are oftentimes when things may go over, but I mean, we have a history, so to speak, of overruns. And that is going to put us in a position to where there's going to be an increase in taxes if we don't change the way we're doing things. And our goal is to be the best steward and guardian of taxpayer dollars and to have management and fiscal oversight in place that does not put taxpayers in that predicament unnecessarily.
Okay. You know, costs is one side of the equation. You know, you did mention raising taxes, or you know, I guess the revenue side of it. Taxes are always, the revenue side of government. But how about impact fees? I mean, we have clearly moved out of the recession, and there is a little bit of a building boom going on. You know, are impact fees as useful a way to raise revenue for a city like Sarasota?
They are, but going back to the tax revenue point in terms of raising taxes, if we do better in terms of managing our projects and managing the things that we will spend and timing, we can bring down the potential for raising taxes. So that's where I am in terms of having a better plan as to how we spend our dollars and making sure that we do the due diligence that's necessary before we enter into projects. But getting to your question about the impact fees, of course, that is a way that can help to generate revenue and dollars, but it has to be done in a reasonable way across the board. and there has to be transparency in that process. So I agree that because we're coming out of the recession, there is an opportunity for some growth there, but we can't just use that as a way to get out of good governing. We still have to make better decisions. We still have to have proper oversight. We still have to engage and ask the tough questions. And sometimes from a staff standpoint, we've got to dig deeper and figure out whether or not we have correct priorities in funding and proposals. So it's a two-sided coin, in my opinion.
Yeah, and just for those who don't know what we're talking about when we talk about impact fees are generally charges to developers compensate for building new roads, adding new infrastructure, things like that. When someone builds a new development.
Right, that's correct. And when we're looking at, how impact fees are assigned, we've got to look at the proximity to the central core. Downtown is our central core. And to the extent that there's building that occurs in downtown where less infrastructure is required, there may be some incentives that can be provided so that we can encourage growth in a way that will increase impact fees. If we're in an area where there's more infrastructure, then, of course, there's going to be more in the way of impact fees to be able to provide the necessary utilities, planning, zoning that's in place, parking requirements that are necessary to make a development be profitable and reasonable for the community. So I think we do need to look at the code and see if there are ways that we can make some revisions where necessary, and also to do it in a way that doesn't impede individuals from coming into the corridor. And those answers depend upon the area of development. Development is going to be different in the downtown district than from my district in District 3. We are heavily neighborhood-driven. There is a consensus of wanting to maintain the tranquility and the peace and quiet of neighborhoods, and so those analyses are going to be different based upon the proximity of the development.
Yeah, I just want to remind everybody we're speaking to Shelley Friedland Eddy. This is WSLR FM 96.5. That is actually true. Sort of shifting gears a little bit to get to one of what is probably the thornier or at least most reported issues for the city of Sarasota is in fact the homeless issue. I know right here where our studio is, we're right next to Renaissance House, and we get to see it firsthand every time we come to the station. What do you think about the homeless issue? Do you agree with the recommendations made by Robert Marbot, or is there another way to solve the problem?
I think it's a combination. We've got to look back, from a fiscal, responsibility initiative in terms of, bringing in an expert that has, cost city taxpayers in excess of $100,000, and then the city's residents' perspective that the city may be failing to follow the recommendations that were made by Dr. Marbot. One of the things we've got to look at is whether or not those recommendations fit the demographic of our community, and then we've got to figure out a way to put forth recommendations that are consistent with what we need. Coming forward, I think it's a combination of reviewing some of the recommendations that were made in that Marbot plan, but then going forward to have a true sense of what our city needs. I agree with you in terms of, the severity of our crisis. We have a responsibility, to provide services and to protect business owners, to provide services, and to make all of our city a safe, walkable, vibrant place to live and work. So the question is, how do we do that? Well, I know you may be aware that, there was a recent recommendation by the city manager, Mr. Barwin, that promotes a new 8-point plan. This is a plan that is supposed to alleviate homelessness, and it may include a funding mechanism, and they're determining whether or not that's going to be through maybe a proposed county liquor tax. So we've got to look and see, one, how we can afford this plan. But the other part of the plan is it just transitional housing? Is it a shelter? Does it provide the transitional services to rehabilitate our residents? And does it give our neighborhoods a sense of safety and security? So I think it's a multi-phase plan. What the city has proposed in terms of selecting a coordinator, I think it has to be the right coordinator. We need to know what we're good at and what we need assistance with. And within the city, if we don't have the expertise to address some of those homeless issues, then we may look for some outside help. But at the same time, we've got to decide in a methodical, strategic plan what we can do on an ongoing basis. And then the other part of that is there's got to be, renewed communications with our county to kind of start those discussions again.
You know, it seems to me from what I read about it, all these plans, Mr. Barwin's plan and Marvitt's plan, you know, multi-point plans, you know, include, you know, some sort of also a word that I've taken from the paper, triage to determine, you know, which homeless are homeless, you know, what type of homeless we're dealing with, you know, because people don't seem, or it isn't really clear to a lot of people. There is, quote unquote, the chronic homeless, and then there's, you know, those folks that just, like, kind of lost their job in the recession and haven't been able to find another one, and they're living in their car, but they will eventually come back. I mean, is this part of these other plans? What are some of the features, I guess, of these plans that you would support?
You've talked about what we have to do, and it's so true in terms of determining who is in our homeless population, and it's so true that the other part of it is that we've got to deal with the workforce housing, you know, ability to be able to live in our community, because there is a situation where some of the homeless individuals are just in transition because of a fiscal setback. Then there are the chronic homeless that we've discussed in terms of, you know, maybe there may be mental health issues. Maybe there may be issues where an individual has not worked in years and doesn't have the ability to regain employment and be able to live on their own, but causes a danger to the community. So that is definitely part of what the plan needs to include, who is our homeless population, and making sure that we're not just having a one-fit answer that doesn't support all of our population. So once we determine, you know, who's in our housing population, then we can work with partners to develop the best response in terms of addressing transitional issues, referrals for assistance, mental health screening, possible support from the law enforcement. And so it's a big puzzle that we've got to solve together, and we've got to have some cooperation. You know, here recently we've dealt with, because of fiscal issues and inability to find housing, that some of the homeless find themselves in the jail population. And we know from speaking, you know, with the county that that's not what the jails were intended to do, was to house the homeless. So we've got to do a better job of making resources available.
Yeah, that sounds good. You know, this is a little off the track. I just want to remind everybody that are listening to WSLR 96.5 FM, and we're speaking with Shelley Friedland Eddy, who is running for County Sarasota City Commission. You know, this is a little off the track, but I did, in the course of my research, read an article in the Sarasota paper that I didn't realize that you debated John Morgan last election cycle about, he came in for United for Care, you know, about the medical marijuana amendment, and I'm just curious about your stance on legalizing medical marijuana. Were you basically against the amendment, or are you against the legalizing of medical marijuana?
I was against the amendment as it was written. One of the things that we dealt with, you know, particularly as an attorney and being a problem solver, we have to look at, does any proposed constitutional amendment bring about a new set of consequences for different populations? And one of the issues with regard to the amendment as it was proposed is that it didn't, in my opinion, have enough safeguards in terms of determining who medical professionals were, determining access to the medical marijuana, determining safeguards for communities, and also determining alternatives from a law enforcement perspective. So those were the major reasons that I did not support the amendment as it was written, because there seemed to be additional questions that would have been created by the constitutional amendment. I definitely think that we need to make sure that we support every effort that can provide additional assistance to our ailing, ill population in terms of providing support for chronic illness. But I think that the amendment as it was written did not go far enough to do that.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. One just last little question. If such a thing did get passed, what would be the role of, say, a city commission in, regulating or enforcing such a
Well, the city commission would play a role in terms of zoning and land use requirements. You know, if there was a determination that facilities and clinics were constitutional and legal, then our city would have to make a determination from a zoning and regulation standpoint as to what's a good proximity for a facility that would make medical marijuana available. Is it in a place that's in close proximity to children and the elderly and other vulnerable populations? And does it cause additional hardships from a city perspective? So that would be one of the initial decisions that a city commission would have to make. And if you have followed the news, the city of Palmetto has already taken some steps to create some zoning legislation that would determine what are the best places from a safety and medical standpoint for facilities to be created.
Terrific. We're running out of time, so could you quickly remind our listeners when they can cast their vote?
Yes. Well, as you know, we talked about Sarasota City Commission. I am the one of the candidates for City Commission for District 3, and absentee ballots were mailed out this past Tuesday on April the 7th. Early voting begins on May the 4th, and Election Day is on May the 12th. And I'm running because I have had enough life experiences and critical thinking and problem-solving opportunities to be able to bring fresh ideas, a new perspective, and out-of-the-box thinking to the commission that can help us move some of the issues forward. We've talked about issues with relation to our homeless crisis. There are issues that we're going to need to tackle in the ways of smart development for the downtown corridor, protecting our parks and our green spaces in our neighborhoods, and also solving the pension crisis for our retired law enforcement and first responders. So those are just a few of the issues that this next commission will be tasked with addressing in the next 4 years, and it will literally change the face of our city. So I'm confident that I'll be able to represent the needs of our district and not just speak for them, but speak on their behalf. And so that's why I'm asking for the vote of the residents of the city of District 3.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Shelley. And just very, very quickly, tell people where they can learn more about you.
Yes, you can go to our website. It's www.S4districtdistrict3.net. And we're also on Facebook at Shelley Freeland Eddy for District 3. And you can also go to the Sarasota website, sarasotavotes.com.
Terrific. Thanks again for coming on. You have a great day, Shelley.
Thank you so much. You too.
Right.
Bye-bye.
All right, there we go. Local politics here, and Eddie's running against Stan Zimmerman, and that's coming up. All right, we have our next guest, Confession of a D.C. Madam with Henry Vinson, coming up, which is right after this Media Matters Minute.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Whitehouse. On Fox News, host Neil Cavuto discussed the Department of the Interior's new fracking regulation with the Accountability Project's president, Namiki Konst. Listen to how Cavuto misses Kant's claim that fracking pollutes water supplies.
The problem is that fracking has proven to infect water supply. They use 650 chemicals.
How do you know it's proven to do that?
Because the majority of scientists have proven it. So when you
Don't you think if there was an egregious problem, I mean, it would have been stopped.
Cavuto's other guest, the Harlan Institute's Jay Lair, was also in denial about fracking pollution.
I was involved in an hydraulic fracturing project on an oil well in Texas in 1961. And we really haven't proven that there's been a single water supply well contaminated.
But there are hundreds of documented cases of leaky fracking wells contaminating water supplies, including in Pennsylvania, Texas, and West Virginia.
All right.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
And we just want to thank Media Matters, and they're our nonprofit out of Washington, D.C., that supplies us with that audio. And once again, you're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. This is News and Public Affairs, Surreal News. I'm Steve Norris. My co-host, Lou Larini, is going to introduce our next guest.
Yeah, joining us today is author Henry Vinson, who wrote a book describing his experiences running a gay escort service in Washington, D.C., called Confessions of a D.C. Madam. This all occurred during the late 1980s. The book describes the subsequent arrest and unexpected incarceration. Good morning, and thanks for coming on, Henry.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Henry, you know, I read quite a bit of your book. I have to admit, I didn't read it all, but I couldn't put it down really once I started, you know, because it reads more like a novel than a nonfiction expose. Not to say that I don't believe you, you know, it's just that, you know, some of it is pretty darn fantastic. You know, let's start with you telling us how you went from being, I guess, a mortuary director to running an escort service.
Well, I ran the largest gay escort service that's ever been exposed in Washington, D.C., and my ultimate downfall was precipitated by the fact that I provided escort to a CIA asset named Craig Spence, and he used my escorts to blackmail politicians and other power brokers, and ultimately I became the fall guy for a sprawling conspiracy whose cover-up was engineered at the pinnacle of the Bush administration. So I went to Washington, D.C. to work for a large funeral home chain there, and we went out one evening for a social gathering to an exotic dance bar.
Yeah, excuse me a second, Henry. You know, I hate to interrupt you, but are you on a speakerphone?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay. Are you speaking into the you know, because we somehow have a real kind of a sketchy connection. It's going in and going out.
Is this any better?
Yeah, a little bit better.
Okay.
Okay. Continue. I'm sorry.
So we went out for the social gathering to an exotic dance bar. I'd never been to anything like that before, coming from a small town. And I met one of the exotic dancers who just happened to also be an escort. And I got to know him quite well over the next couple of weeks. And it turns out the place where he worked was for sale. The owner had AIDS, and he wanted to sell the business. I ended up buying it, and that's the way I got started into that business.
Yeah, and that was Jimmy, I guess. And
that's right, Jimmy, yeah. Macko.
Yeah, and that I really have to say, I mean, as you pointed out, you know, you are in fact an astute businessman, you know, and you did take this what was, you know, I guess, profitable business, but not really that aggressive, made it into something that was pretty big. I mean, with use of technology and you know, good management, I guess.
That's right. They ran it rather inefficiently, and after observing the operation, I thought, wow, if I made a few changes, I could really turn this into a very big dating service, and then that's what I did. And I went through the telephone directory. I noticed there were a lot of disconnected lines, and I contacted the phone company to pay the past due balances to get the telephone numbers so I would have instant Yellow Page ads. And that's the way that it grew into such a large service.
You know, but like with so many things in life, you know, there's you know, pluses and minuses and yin and yang. And when you got big, you know, that was when you met Craig Spence, right? You know, who you have dubbed is the Prince of Darkness. And that is certainly, at least from what I read in your book, when things started to get a little dark in your life, too. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Sure. Craig Spence was a very interesting man. He was a CIA asset. He was a lobbyist. He was also had lavish parties at his upscale home almost on a daily basis. These parties would look like a who's who of Washington, D.C. There would be media personalities there, government officials, elected officials, and he would have literally everything. And that's where I met Craig, because I would supply escorts for him. He would have beautiful young escorts for many of his visitors, along with drugs in his house. What I didn't realize initially is that he was recording everything in the house, that he had two-way mirrors, and the house was set up for audio and video recording.
So he used this to, you know, blackmail, I guess, some of the public figures, I guess, that he invited to the party?
That's right. He would have these parties with people in Bush administration. There was a cabinet member there. There were military officials there. there was just about anybody who was somebody would be at Craig's parties, and he would videotape those. So I did realize that later because he did the same thing to me. But he was a lobbyist and a very influential lobbyist, so I suspect that's the way that he was able to accomplish so much.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, having that kind of sway over, men in power, men in Congress, as a lobbyist, permitted him to accomplish perhaps some things that, other lobbyists couldn't.
That's right. I think that's the way he was able to accomplish so much.
You know, but Spence, though, as you point out in your book, and, I did do a little research on my own about who this guy is, he's now deceased, but, him and another guy were also involved in sort of an escort service, but it was mostly for procuring adolescent boys. And I think, as you pointed out in your book, he tried to get you involved, but that was where you said, that was a line you weren't going to cross, right?
That's right. I never got involved in that. And I think the worst thing that I ever saw in that business, the most disturbing and sinister thing I was exposed to, was the fact that politicians and power brokers were provided with children if they had those inclinations. And I was consistently pressured by D.C. power brokers to provide child prostitutes to their power broker cronies. But I refused to have anything to do with child prostitution. And the government was aware of that fact because I told my government debriefers about that interstate pedophile network that was providing D.C. politicians and power brokers with children. And the Department of Justice, Secret Service, FBI, they covered up that network. But Craig Spence and Larry King, it's Lawrence King, they were running their own escort service with underage children, adolescent boys.
That's amazing. What eventually caused your downfall? You were eventually arrested. What caused that? Was it Craig Spence? Did he like set you up?
I don't think Craig Spence caused my ultimate downfall. I don't think he masterminded it, but Craig Spence was a D.C. power broker and a CIA asset whose upscale D.C. home was bugged for audiovisual blackmail. He even arranged midnight tours of the White House for some of the escorts that I employed. And because I became enmeshed with Spence, that ultimately led to my downfall. I was privy to Spence's blackmail enterprises, his collusion with the Secret Service, and also his pandering of children to his power broker cronies. So I ultimately became the man who knew too much because the shadowy network that protected Spence was affiliated with the highest levels of the government, and I had become a major liability. And a corrupt grand jury was ultimately engineered by the U.S. Attorney for D.C., and they exonerated Spence and hammered me with a 43-count RICO indictment. So I was looking at 295 years in prison.
Wow, but then you went out and got a lawyer who you thought was going to be great. You got Greta Van Susteren, right? And didn't she initially lead?
That's right. I did get Greta Van Susteren, and I was very disappointed with the way Greta Van Susteren represented me because the government accomplished its two objectives when she was my attorney, my silence and imprisonment. At the onset of my case, she filed an 11-page motion to mandate the release of my clientele list that the government had previously seized from me. And Greta argued that the names of my patrons should be released because if the government's assertion was accurate and my escort service was in actuality a prostitution ring, my clients aided and abetted a criminal enterprise. She said she felt that forcing the government to disclose my clientele would abate its zealous prosecution of me. But the U.S. Attorney for D.C. contested that motion, and the judge in my case sided with the prosecution and barred the disclosure of my clientele. So once the trial judge acquiesced to the U.S. Attorney's office, Greta started to change her tune, and she urged me to take the government's plea agreement, which was 5 years in prison, and I ultimately entered into a plea agreement with the government, and I spent days being debriefed by the government. And I told them everything I knew, everything I'd witnessed, which was very incriminating. But Greta, unbelievably, didn't attend any of those debriefing where I was incriminating myself.
Geez, that's kind of interesting. I mean, I would have thought. I mean, you know, anybody that even watches, you know, their only knowledge of the legal system is what they see in TV cop shows. Knows that anytime a felon, I guess, or someone or an accused person, you know, is being interviewed by the police, their attorney is going to be there. That's kind of weird. But did you ever get any explanation of that? I mean, or is it just because she was working with the government to set you up?
I never did get an explanation of it. And, you know, I was promised that the government would be very lenient with me. But, of course, that's not what happened. Because I did get sentenced within the federal sentencing guidelines for 63 months.
You know, so you did spend the 5 years in jail, I guess. In 2008, you know, there was another person who was dubbed the DC Madam, Deborah Jean Palfrey. Is there any similarity between your story and hers?
Well, I think there's a few similarities to us. We both ran escort services in Washington, D.C., and both of us were dubbed the D.C. Madam by the press. The federal government subjected both Ms. Palfrey and me to a crucible that was designed to ensure our silence or ultimately crush us. And Ms. Palfrey was merely running an escort service when the Justice Department smacked her with a 14-count RICO indictment. And I was walloped with a 43-count RICO indictment, so I was potentially looking at 295 years in prison. And I think Ms. Palfrey became overwhelmed by the Justice Department's crucible, and she was unwilling or unable to cope with the government fleecing her, all of her money and status, and depositing her in federal prison. And whereas I do many other things, I did go to mortuary school. I'm a commercial pilot, flight instructor. And I think that's mostly what she ever did, was running an escort service, whereas I do many other things and did many other things at the time as well.
You know, do you think the fact that, your escort service catered to gay men as opposed to straight men had an influence on how you were treated by the law?
Oh, yes, absolutely I do. I think my sexual orientation, because I ran a gay escort service during the Bush 1 and Reagan administration, many of the politicians and power brokers that I provided with escorts were closeted Republicans. And it would have been a death knell to their career if it came out that they were soliciting the service of gay escorts. So I do think that it played a big role in it.
Well, you know, I mean, as you mentioned in your book, like I guess there is, you know, like the Republican legislator Larry Craig, who was caught in soliciting gay sex in a Minnesota airport bathroom. That he was like longtime gay guy, but you know, publicly, you know, he spoke out against gay marriage. I mean, he was, you know, sort of hardcore, on the wrong side of gay issues. Isn't that right?
Oh, yes. Larry Craig's a great example of the hypocrisy of closeted Republicans that pervaded the Reagan administration with regards to gay rights civil legislation. Craig developed quite a reputation for voting against gay legislation. He voted for a constitutional ban of same-sex marriage, and he voted against expanding hate crimes to include sexual orientation. In fact, the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest gay and lesbian civil rights organization, gave him a 0% concerning his stance on gay rights legislation. So Senator Larry Craig, he proved to be a major hypocrite.
Yeah, and it sounds to me from your book that, he was a pretty prolific customer of your business.
Yes, and there were quite a few clients that were fairly well known. Charles Dutcher was the Associate Director of Presidential Personnel in the Reagan administration. Paul Ballack, a dear friend of mine, and Labor Secretary Elizabeth Dole's political personnel liaison to the White House. And William Casey, who was the the best known of my clients because he was the director of the CIA.
Huh. Interesting. You know, this. First of all, I just want to remind everybody we're speaking to Henry Vinson. You know, the author of Confessions of a DC Madam. Describing his experiences in the late 1980s, running a gay escort service in Washington D.C. And this is WSLR 96.5 FM. As I just said, all this happened in the 1980s. Jail time is behind you. What prompted you to tell your story now?
Well, I have two objectives for telling my story now. First, I want to tell my side of the story because I've been subjected to a 25-year campaign of character assassination by the media. And second, I believe the American political system has become a wayward aberration of the ideas it was built upon. And I believe that blackmail has played an integral role in hijacking our political system. And that's why I decided to write the book 25 years after this experience that I had.
Okay. And, you seem to, as you alluded to earlier, did have other skills, unlike Deborah Jean Palfrey. You are a pretty astute businessman, and I guess when you came out of school, you got a master's degree. What are you doing these days besides writing books?
Well, I work as a consultant in marketing and advertising. I'm a commercially rated pilot in airplanes and helicopters, and I did go back to West Virginia University and get a master's degree in integrated marketing, and I'm currently in law school at Taft Law School.
My co-host, Steve Norris has a quick question. Steve?
Hi, Henry. Thank you so much for joining us. My question is, with your vast experience, and you've been in D.C., and you're a pilot, and all this, I mean, you've had a tremendous life experience. Just sort of looking back, what would you say would be lessons that you've learned, or maybe things that you might have done differently, if you could sort of speak to yourself in the past? What things, would, looking back, do you think that, what would be your take-home messages here?
Well, I think the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche says, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And that quote is near and dear to my heart because I've endured a number of tragedies in my life, and I was determined not to let them destroy me. In fact, they galvanized my will and spurred me to reach for success. But Nietzsche also should have said, what doesn't kill you often hurts like hell. Plus, I think living a good life is the best revenge, and I've managed to forge a wonderful life for myself despite the repeated persecution by the government and media. But I think education's the key, and that's why I went back to school, got a master's degree, and I think education's the key to having a successful life.
Henry, that is great, and I'm glad that, this story had, I guess you call it a happy ending. I just want to remind everybody that we're speaking to Henry Vincent, who wrote Confessions of a DC Madam, which is available now. And, this is WSLR 96.5 FM, your community radio station. And Henry, why don't you tell people how they can get a hold of the book? I can't say how much, but you can tell them where they can get it.
Yeah, don't mention price.
Sure. The book's available on Amazon. It's available at Barnes & Noble and on the publisher's website, Trinidad. And you can also go to my website, henryvinson.com, and it's available there as well.
And I also want to thank your publisher, Booth Media, that supplies us with you as a guest. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Have a great day. Good luck with everything.
Thank you.
All right, there's some surreal news for you here. Confessions of a DC Madam. In this case, we're talking about a gay escort service out of Washington, D.C. And he mentioned head of CIA and some other very influential people under the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, a little bit under Reagan, too, were involved heavily. And they had video taken, and they were being blackmailed. This is the way I want our government to be run. A bunch of people being blackmailed by an escort service. behind the scenes determining what happens to our government.
I'll tell you what, after what I read in the book and knowing that I was going to be asking questions about this guy, Craig Spence, you just Google Craig Spence and see what you get.
Wow.
I mean, this guy's amazing.
And avoid jail time.
He ended up killing himself.
Yeah.
He actually committed suicide in the Ritz-Carlton in Boston. And I have to admit, his alma mater, he went to Boston College in 1963.
Yeah.
And it was 10 years before me. So.
All right, real quickly, because we're at the end here. Next week is our fun drive. We have Christine Jennings going to be joining
us.
That's that show. All the news and views and everything that you heard here are not those employees. It's volunteers or it's board members, just the people that gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest. We have Complex Waveform coming on after this. Listen to Stratosphere Sarasota alternate Wednesdays from 9 to 9:30 with Andre Gratis and Nancy Norris, my wife, and sometimes I sit in on that show as well. Lou Larini is my fabulous co-host here. Thank you for getting the guests here. And that's it.
Thank you, Steve. Have a great Friday.
All right, Complex Waveforms. What do we got here? We have... I'm not sure if I can pronounce it here, but Tinariwen. Some great music with Mark Zampella. Don't touch that dial. Thanks for tuning in to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. You're a true community radio station. Here's Complex Waveforms.